Welcome to Marketers Talking Marketing.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Marketers Talking. Today we're joined with Mickey. Tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
So my name is Mickey Kennedy. I run eReleases press release distribution at eReleases.com. We are 25 years old, so I've been doing this a long time. And I'm really passionate about PR and specifically about using press releases to get PR and predominantly for small businesses, entrepreneurs, speakers, authors, people in that space.
I feel like press releases are this kind of mystical thing where people know they should do them, aren't really sure when to do them or how to do them or how to really pull them in. And I've been hearing more and more early stage startups actually going to press as one of their first investments instead of demand gen or product marketing. So I think it's definitely something people are trying to figure out. If someone is let's say a small business and they're thinking about releasing a press release on their own, where do they get started with press?
Right. So, one of the first things that people do is they look at what other people are doing press release wise, and they just feel like we should do something similar. And that may not be the best place to start. I have a free masterclass on the strategic types of releases you should be doing. It's at eReleases.com/plan, P-L-A-N. I intended it for my customers, but anyone's welcome to go there. It's about an hour long. It's sort of is a good place to start because it'll give you an audit, you going through this exercise with your business and seeing if you can't come up with like at least half a dozen ideas for strategic types of press releases you should do. The most common press release that we get at eReleases is a personnel change. And it's usually not a new executive and it's usually not an industry veteran. So I always tell people, I'm like, are you sure you want to spend money to go over wire, for a press release like that, that's probably not going to get any meaningful pickup. At most, maybe the local paper and maybe a trade publication where they have a little on the move section. And the cool thing is you can establish a relationship with both of those on your own and just email them, a photo and a little brief about this new employee. And you'll probably have the same results, if not better, than paying money to go over a service like eReleases.
I imagine that there are people who are listening who go, well, I don't have anything to talk about. I don't have anything to release. Should they spend time kind of trying to think of and build that narrative so they have a thing to release around?
Correct. And when they go through that masterclass, it has a lot of those exercises in which you can sort of develop releases from nothing. One that I always say, if someone comes in and they really feel like they only have enough effort to go through one release to prove them wrong, or they've done a few releases and they've had no meaningful media pickup, we call that earned media, when a journalist writes an article about you. This is distinguished from having the press release replicated on a few websites, which happens naturally when you use a wire service. That meaningful type of press release that never fails is a survey or study within your industry. And, before people start going, oh, it sounds like a lot of work, it doesn't have to be. The most important element of that are the questions. And you want to ask meaningful questions that are relevant today. And so what are the things going on in your industry? Are there people still having struggles in regards to a company culture because people want to work from home or hybrid? Are you having hiring challenges? I've heard a lot of stuff about, quiet quitting and all these other little aspects like that. Questions around that could be useful. Added other questions, what are, other things that are specific to your industry that you read in recent publications that might be a trend or something to look out for? Asking questions, have they seen that? Asking questions, what's your marketing spend look like over the next quarter or two quarters? Could signal, some economic uncertainty in the industry. So I recommend 16 questions, pick those. Put them in SurveyMonkey. I like structuring them 4 questions per page. So if someone stops halfway, you've got 8 responses, and hopefully you've loaded the important questions first. And at the end, that's the place where I feel like you can be a little creative, maybe throw in a wild question or a crazy question, you know, something from left field, you know, something like if you were at a trade show or conference, you might just, you know, take someone aside and say, hey, have you really noticed this? Those sometimes can be some of the best questions. We had one that a local auto repair shop in Pennsylvania did. They felt like, who are we to do a survey? But I talked them into it because they were looking for automotive trade publications to link to them. And having a great resource page for the survey is a great link and ensures that a lot of people will link to you. And if you're looking for automotive links, you know, that was a survey was the great way to do it. Put that together. The left field question that was asked was, what's the strangest thing someone left in their car while being repaired? And we just left a couple fields open for them to write an anecdote. And it was not statistically relevant because I don't think anybody had the same answer, but they were wild and strange. And, you know, there was a few hundred responses, but, you know, we picked like the top 50 and sort of, you know, culled some of those for the press release. We didn't put all 50 in the press release, but we linked back to the website. It did very well. I mean, it went very, what I would categorize as viral. I think, you know, over 20 publications picked it up, including their local newspaper. I think there was also a city publication, business publication as well, that thought it was a lot of fun. And so, you know, for them, the goal was to get industry links, which are considered authority for SEO, because they had a new domain name. Their old domain name was tied to the Yellow Pages. And I don't know what happened, but they just said, they're not doing it anymore. And we asked, well, can we get the domain and website that we've been using? And they're like, well, we don't really have a way to hand it off. We know. And so they were stuck, you know, with a new website, and they weren't ranking at all. And yeah. So they went to someone, and someone said, let me talk to Mickey. And I ended up talking to them, and we did it with, I think, more than 12 of the trade publications linked to them. Not all of them did, but, you know, it's more than half. And within 60 days, maybe 90 days, they were up number one for when you type in their city and auto repair. And that was the goal, you know, not to mention all of the mentions they said they got from local people saying they thought it was really cool. And they saw the survey. And, it's really impressive, you know, for a little auto repair shop in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania to all of a sudden have done a survey and got picked up by, you know, Cranes and all these other specific automotive trade publications. It really was like a feather in their cap. And those kinds of things can happen and be really meaningful. And the survey is just one of those things to do, you know. And who did they send it to? You know, they don't know, you know, hundreds of people that are other auto repair shops. We just partnered with it wasn't local. It was a National Independent Repair Shop Trade Association. So it was a trade association for independent auto repair shops. They were a member. But even if they weren't, you could just approach them and just say, hey, we're doing a survey. Could you send this link to your members? In exchange, we'll mention you in a press release we'll be issuing over the wire. The smaller and independent trade associations don't get any media attention. It's the large ones that do. And so they will often see this as a win-win. I've had a few clients that I've coached through this where they'll come back and say, could we co-brand the survey? I don't see a downside on that as long as they don't want to take ownership and control the whole process, which, you know, the large trade associations, I don't think they would even be interested in this, but if they did, they would want to control every element of it. And so it doesn't have to be hugely complicated. In this case, I handled it for the auto repair shop. I don't think I put, you know, the most we put into were the questions we asked. And at the end, we abandoned most of the questions and just went with the strange question and responses, which is not usually what we do. But in that case, we did. And, you know, ideally, you know, in a normal survey, you'll pick two or three questions that you felt like were the biggest or most important or the biggest surprises. You'll focus the press release on that. You're not going to focus on all the questions. You'll provide a link to a page on your website where you do have all the questions and responses. And sometimes a really, you know, creative a journalist can go in there and flesh out a different story. And that might be something else you could do with a subsequent press release. But, you know, you're going to position yourself as the expert. You're going to quote yourself as to why you felt the numbers skewed a particular way. And as a result, you know, you'll get media pickup. The least I've ever seen is 4 articles, but on average, it's usually between 8 and 14 articles every time we do a survey or study, you know, with a client.
Nice. I love that too, because you're becoming a source of first party data. You're becoming a source that can be quoted where you're not positioned as going in with some commercial benefit, even though ultimately, you know, we're all in business to be in business. So there is typically a commercial skew, but you're coming in as like, hey, here's some just interesting data. And I feel like someone would be more inclined to pick that up and run with it versus just covering to help promote some like small shop.
Sure. And, you know, the other most common press release we get at e-releases is a usually a product or service launch. And, you know, a lot of those are, here's the product, here's a list of features, and here's a link to go find more information and buy it. And, you know, one of the things you have to be aware of is, you know, journalists are, you know, naturally they want to be storytellers and they want to build a story arc. And it's hard to do that when you just have, here's the product, here's some features, here's a buy button. And so to those people, I push back and say, hey, you know, I'm sure you had people beta test it. Oh yeah, we had this guy use it. He had a great response. He had this result. And I'm like, that needs to be in the press release. You need a case study, you know, case study in the press release, you know, what their results were and ideally a quote from them. And all of a sudden that's a lot more of an interesting story arc in a product launch. So, you know, those are the types of things you just have to be mindful of. So many times people approach PR as like, this is important to us and we want to sell more. And so this is the press release we wrote with that in mind. And what you have to realize is you've now sent it to a gatekeeper who's protecting his audience from, you know, what they feel is the most, you know, important or entertaining or educational information. And, you know, do you qualify in that respect? And, you know, what are the elements that you could put in there that, you know, would give you a lift in educating or entertaining the person? You know, that's sort of what you have to do. You have to sort of almost reverse engineer the press release with them in mind and making sure that you're really giving something of value that the audience would want to read, or in the case of TV or radio, listen to or view. And, you know, it really is that simple. But, you know, there are a lot of little hacks and little types of releases that you can do that are in this way more meaningful. You know, we talked about first person data, you know, taking data that's already publicly available and punching into your press release. You know, you've got a product launch and you're like, you know, our product is so important because, you know, we solve this logistics problem that is central to companies. And, you know, 63% of companies that fail in the first 5 years in our industry is often because of these three things, of which logistics is probably the most important. Put those numbers in the press release. It helps anchor and show the stakes to the reader of the importance of this product. And so taking data that's already out there and incorporating into the release will give you a lot more meaningful stakes and really resonate with people. Other things that I recommend in my masterclass is looking for industry blind spots or gaps in reporting. You know, are there things that when you go to a trade show, a conference, you always talk about because you never see it in print, you never see it online, but yet every time you get together, it's the thing that you want to talk about and get other people's perspective on. That is usually ripe for putting in a press release, especially if you're looking for industry specific trade publications to cover it. You know, we did a campaign with a carpet company in New Jersey. I will admit, I told them I didn't think it was going to work from the beginning and they should save their money, but they said it had already been allocated to their department and they were going to use it, whether it was with me or someone else. So I said, okay, let's go along for the ride. So we did a press release every month. And after month 4 of no pickup, you know, I said, we need to go back and brainstorm and just try to rethink different ways to attack this. And you know, one of the questions I went through was an exercise, and it was like, who's your biggest enemy? I thought you'd say, oh, it's Al across the street with his carpet emporium. But he said it was the big box home improvement stores. And he just sort of went into almost a rant about how bad Home Depot and Lowe's is for the carpet industry. You know, one of the things he said is they will often come into a home where people got carpet from them, and it's only 6 or 7 years old, and they're calling them to replace it. And they look at the carpet, and the carpet is fine. The padding is terrible, and that's probably why it looks worn. But even more importantly, it's never been properly stretched from the beginning, and the seams are usually visible. And the reason for that is Home Depot and Lowe's don't normally call carpet installers to see if they're interested in installing carpet. They call a list of people who have a home improvement license in the state, and they start at the A's, and they call and say, hey, we have someone who needs carpet installed tomorrow. And if you're a roofer who has a home improvement license and you got that call and you don't have any work that week, maybe you're going to go to YouTube that night, and the next day you're going to install carpet. Not well, but you're going to install it. So we put together a David versus Goliath press release is how I categorized it. And we talked about, you know, this this blind spot that no one was talking about in the carpet industry, about how bad you know, the big box home improvement stores are and how they have to compete against them. It went viral, and as much as you can go viral in the carpet industry. Over a dozen trade publications picked it up, and they loved it. And a few of them wrote back and said, we've never got so much of a response to this. Everybody who subscribes to these publications are other carpet companies. They all see this, and it really resonated with them. We continue to do aspects of that same focus for the remainder of the campaign. And at the end of the year, we had, I think, over 30 media pickups. Most of them were trade publications, which I pointed out to them. Their customers don't read those, but they had a plan. They did get picked up in a local newspaper and New Jersey Magazine, which was really great for them because that's where they were located. They built a brag book, and they put it in a binder of all the clippings, and they printed it out. And every time they go to someone's home and give them a quote, they would open that and say, here we are. We've been picked up in Floor Trade Weekly, this place, this place. We may not come in as the cheapest, but we have a great reputation, and we know how to install carpet. And you know, you'll never have to call us back to restretch the carpet or fix a seam that's visible, because we do it right from the beginning. And they started converting about 17% more of those consultations just by adding that brag book. And oh, that really goes to show the importance of media, you know, that it really is an indicator of social proof. It almost acts like an implied endorsement when a journalist writes about you. It's huge credibility, and no one else that comes into the sales process is going to have that package of credibility to compete with. And so you just, you know, almost a 20% bump in conversion rates just by adding that to the consultation.
Now, you mentioned that they were doing kind of regular cadence, it sounds like, a press releases before they start getting a lot of traction with it. Do you recommend people try and do one a month, one a quarter? Is there kind of a magic volume in there?
There really isn't. I have all different types of clients who try lots of different styles. It's mostly what works for them. And for somebody who hasn't done a PR campaign and doesn't have a lot of milestones that they can think of, and maybe they're working off my, you know, strategies, you know, it's a lot of you know, to them, it's a commitment. And so maybe it's like every other month, maybe it's like quarterly. And so maybe it might take you a year and a half to do 6 to 8 releases, which is generally what we recommend for testing a PR campaign, to do 6 to 8 releases. You know, you can never really judge it by one. And I will be honest with you, if you do 6 to 8 releases and you do them following the ones that I recommend that are more strategic, you probably still are going to have more than half of those not result in any earned media. You'll get your press release on a few websites, but you won't get the articles. And it really is, you know, testing and seeing what works. The one exception I mentioned is the survey, but I also recommend it's a pretty big ask for people. But even that, it doesn't have to be. It's very procedural. And I really do break it down just like I did today. It, you know, it is attainable and something that you can do. And so The same way you would never start a Google ad campaign and shut off a campaign after you got 12 clicks and no buys, you really can't judge a single press release. You really have to test and try different approaches. You know, in the case of, you know, my clients, often like we did with the carpet company, we continued to do variations on the same theme and try different things, and it continued to work. In the case of the survey, I had one client who, that is all they do now. They represent a lot of different verticals and niches, and they do a survey for each of them. And they're actually the client who inspired this as the idea, because they did this more than 3 years ago, and it worked so well that now they've been doing it annually for these 30 to 40 verticals. So they're doing 30 to 40 surveys a year, 30 to 40 releases a year. And they are getting, like I said, 8 to 14 on average articles for each of those, all with links to these niches on their website. And they're just getting tons of traffic and authority. And now they're just like recognized industry-wide as being a very important company. And you know, 3 to 4 years ago, they were just known as a review site. And so that's been so meaningful to their brand, their reputation, and their authority. And, you know, people, you know, now pay considerably to be reviewed by them and, you know, try to work out a relationship to work with them. And so, you know, that's what happens when you get media authority. People want to work with you. You know, when I read a great Kickstarter campaign article, I often will click through and, you know, want to do business with that company if it's affordable. I want to support them. And the same thing happens with a lot of people who read articles. I've never had that from an ad. I've never seen an ad and said, whoa, I need to go to that website right now and buy. I will go sometimes hesitantly with some restraint and click, and I'm like, okay, that's good. I'll file that away to research later. But, you know, it's not the same experience. And so that's one of the powerful things about PR and how, you know, it can really make a huge difference for someone.
I'm honestly kicking myself a little bit on the survey front, because I love surveys. I used to run growth marketing for a tech company, and we did a survey at all of our events as a method for getting more data. So when someone was standing in queue to win the Lego or the Switch or whatever giveaway it was, we would have a survey that they had to fill out to enter. And then we took that data and we would use it to help promote the next conference and, you know, various spots. We made a little ebook, and we never did a press release on it. And I feel like that is such a missed opportunity, because we had like almost 1,000 people respond, and we had a lot of like good trends coming from it.
Sure.
Definitely. I missed that opportunity in retrospect.
Well, it's never too late.
Yeah. I think surveys are one of the most like underrated and underused tools out there.
Right. Yeah. And I think that a lot of people just have the perception that it's just so much work, and it really doesn't have to be. I think if you approach it through procedures, the most, I think, labor intensive aspect of it is really coming up with meaningful questions to ask.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's such a good starting point for people. Is there anything, when you think about PR in 2024 and anyone who's starting to invest in it and thinking about getting more serious, are there other things they should keep in mind or take into consideration?
Yeah, I think that, we get a lot of resistance from people who feel like they're just too small to matter to the media. They feel like this is, something that's really only available to the large, well-funded companies. And the truth of the matter is, you know, the big companies can advertise, and the journalists know that. And journalists also don't get appreciated for covering the latest Microsoft Office rollout. They have to cover it. You know, they have to cover the Googles of the world, the Apples. But they get the most appreciation when they bring up a tool or resource that none of their audience had previously known about. And as a result, they are often small and unknown little businesses. Even mom and pop or even home-based businesses. And for that reason, you know, being small I feel is a huge advantage when it comes to PR. And for anybody who just feels like, I'll wait until I'm bigger or more important, you know, now's the time to take advantage of it because it's going to be more meaningful for you. And I really believe it's easier for a smaller business to get media pickup than one that's a little more established.
Okay. That is a very optimistic view and great to know for those who are out there, because I'm sure there's at least one person listening who's thinking, I'm too small for PR.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of people like that. And then there's also the people who, you know, really haven't refined their business enough. You know, like I deal with people who come to us and they're just like selling a commodity. And I'm like, well, you know, what's your unique selling proposition? How are you different from everybody else selling that? And a lot of them say, we're not. And for them, I think it's not really a PR issue. I think it's a business issue, because I really don't think a lot of businesses are going to be able to survive if they don't sort of define a unique selling proposition. You know, what is it that they're doing that distinguishes them from everybody else? And, you know, for some people, you know, it can be, you know, the onboarding that they provide. It could be, you know, maybe they have a library of video tutorials. You know, sometimes just exploring what you have and what you do can, you know, bring out a unique selling proposition that perhaps you have and just didn't realize it, or really show the necessity for you to create one and sort of develop one into your business. Because, and I think that goes beyond just PR. It really is meaningful for your business, because every business should be able to, you know, be providing something that's distinguishable from everyone else.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not, why are you in business?
Right.
Like, just duplicating someone. I can say firsthand that working with PR firms helped on the marketing front figure out that messaging and positioning and really what are our themes and kind of tie it together. So just anecdotally, PR definitely had a positive impact on my ability as a marketer to really figure out what is that story we're trying to tell. And sometimes it's good just to get an outside perspective of someone who also sees the market more broadly and right. sees what's getting picked up. Yeah. I think this is a great spot to wrap, actually, with this advice. For those who are watching on YouTube, we're going to have all the links in the show notes below. Definitely go check out Mickey's course, check out all the content. And for those listening on Spotify, we'll have them in the show notes, but head over to YouTube for the direct link. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.